Ladies and gentlemen, this commercial is going to use subliminal advertising. That means you will never see or hear the name of the product. Oh, it'll be there on the screen, all right, but the naked eye cannot detect it. This way you sit back, relax, and enjoy me as I tell you this rather funny story.
I have nothing but scorn for all weird ideas other than my own.
And we are like coral animals in a vast reef of excreted technological material that is wired for solid-state data transfer. And within that, we scurry around doing our little tasks, but we come and go. The instrumentality remains and replicates and grows.
Nuttery.
It's buttery, nuttery.
You're going to do a scene with Boris Karloff. Your lines will appear right here. Read them loud and clear.
Come in. You know why I've asked you here.
Hey, Boris. I think you've asked me here to talk about butternuts, juggling scenario, right?
You must convince the villagers that I'm harmless.
Oh, well, that's really not what I do. I mean, I'm just interested in plants mostly. Your issues with the villagers are not really my problem.
You're trembling. Are you afraid?
Just afraid of what will happen to native ecosystems if humans keep on this destructive path.
Have some nice hot coffee. It's butternut. Like it?
Oh, thanks. Sure, coffee sounds good. It's just when we spoke on the phone I thought we were going to be talking about the butternut trees, not butternut coffee.
Butternut has found a way of making coffee richer without being bitter.
I'm sorry, what?
Butternut has found a way of making coffee richer without being bitter. Take this.
Oh, I couldn't. Are we really not going to talk about butternut trees?
Oh, don't worry. I've lots more. Butternut coffee, regular and instant, rich but never bitter.
The world just seems quite crazy at the moment.
Happy Sunday, everybody. Not too much of an intro this week. We're going to get right into it with Amanda Weiss. If you want to reach out to me, you can find me on Instagram at plants.people.r.2, and you can email plantsorpeople2podcast@gmail.com. Enjoy.
My name is Amanda Weiss. I'm a research botanist with the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. We are a team of researchers there doing plant conservation work. And we service the Upper Midwest region. We are housed at basically a botanic center, but we are a field-based conservation program. We do long-term seed banking and conservation strategies for rare plants. So we have one aspect of our program focuses on terrestrial orchids. In Minnesota, there's about 45 species. And we've been working to both seed bank and understand propagation for those species. That's been a really substantial project for us. And then we've sort of expanded that as well to look at the fungal associates for those species. So doing root sampling and fungal extraction, and then pairing those fungal extracts with seed to try to enhance propagation. All of our propagation is actually done in the lab, so we have both the field component for the surveys and the seed collection and the root sampling, and then we have a core of volunteers that help us with propagation in the lab. All has to be done sterile, like under a medical grade hood to avoid contamination. And you have to do that with orchids primarily because of how long it takes for them to germinate. So that's one area of our program. And then another area is general seed banking for non-orchid species. Orchids are sort of different in how we store the seeds. And the collection methods are a little bit different. So the seeds are really small, and when we cold store them, they get static charge. So we have to store them in more specialized, I guess envelopes is the best way to describe them, but we store them slightly differently than other seeds and sort of track them separately. So it sort of operates as its own program. And then the area I focus on more currently is the just generalized seed banking for rare species. So there's no other seed bank in the upper Midwest. So we're trying to basically do a lot of the work that is done in New England and has been done in New England, but we're sort of starting it here. And we don't have a conservation core. So it's myself and David Remicall, he's the program manager, and then we have one part-time person. So we're in the field a lot collecting seed.
Wow. That's is it similar to New England in that you have like a, is there somebody making a list of those important species to, you know, sort of like the New England Wildflower Society would do, you know, like ranking them sort of?
Yeah. So we kind of, so the states here, so specifically like Minnesota has a Department of Natural Resources and they do state ranks for their species, but they don't necessarily prioritize plants for conservation aside from the S ranks. So we can kind of, like our group can kind of filter through those to pick species that we may want to work with. But not every state in the upper Midwest has legal protection for plants. And there's some states that don't have botanists or botanical programs. So we sort of, we're working to build that gap, I would say, to be a conservation group that can function between states, sort of in a similar way that that works in that the New England Botanical groups work with the NEPCOT program. So we our goal is to not be the same, but to function similarly.
And so part of that conservation is also for butternuts.
Yeah, so when I came on, we get sort of notifications of funding opportunities. And because we're a public garden, we are part of the American Public Garden Association. And we got sort of asked if we wanted to apply to do work for any non-orthodox tree species. It's a, there's a collaboration with the Forest Service and APGA, that national group, to fund groups that want to work with non-orthodox seed species of trees. And there aren't many that are listed here in Minnesota, but one of the species that we wanted to work with was butternut. We're at the edge of range for that species, both the northern and western edge of range. So it was recently red listed. I don't know how up to date you are on that, but IUCN just listed that species because of the butternut canker that affects it. The trees are all declining really severely. So we decided to take that on as a small project. It's not a hugely funded project, I would say, but it's important. And it's been fun basically going out and looking for trees and trying to find fruiting trees and following up on leaves and trying to determine if something's a hybrid or not. We don't have as much hybridization as you see in the East Coast. So it is nice when you find trees in the wild. They're usually of native origin, which is, you know, it's nice that we have that opportunity to collect those seeds without as much hybrid interference. But there are a lot of, they call them heartnut trees that are planted on old homesteads. So have to kind of know the land use history before making collections for some of the trees.
Are they crossing with black walnuts?
No, they don't cross with black. They cross with the a Japanese species.
Hmm. Is that Japanese species considered invasive?
No, not here. No. So I think the crosses that were made historically, I don't know how much of the genetics of the non-native butternut are in the hybrids that are planted on the landscape. Definitely a researcher that is more informed on the hybrids and the crossings than I am. So,
you know, I think about like this, the butternut species, and, you know, at least in Vermont, when I see one, they're big and they seem like an older tree, but they don't have, I think they don't have a very long lifespan. They're like 75 years or something, max.
They're pretty short-lived, yep.
And I don't ever see them, you know, it's very common that I would walk into a forested section and see, like, you know, red maple poles or sugar maple poles or black birch or yellow birch or white birch, but I never see a stand of butternut.
See, I mean, from my experience with them is they need really early successional habitat, and they really will get crowded out. So you'll find them usually in places, usually on field edges or floodplain areas, or even along ridge lines, cliff ridges, where you're having like gaps in canopy. But usually in lower areas on the landscape, at least here. In New England, when I would see them, usually in floodplain areas, I would see them sort of coming up. But I think one of the major restrictions for them is shading, is competition. So, yeah, maybe that's influencing like what you're seeing when you're out.
What do you look for when you go out there looking for butternut as, you know, a younger tree? Because even as an older tree, you know, their bark is sort of distinct, but it's not like obviously distinct. It's sort of one of the things that I look at for a while, and I, you know, especially if there's no leaves on it, I roll it around in my head until I eventually come to butternut. But they, you know, it's not like a particularly, you know, it doesn't stand out to me. And so I was wondering if there's anything that you're looking for when you go out there in the woods, that you're looking for like the pole size ones, or, you know, maybe if their bark changes as they get older, what do you look for?
That's a good question. I think I'm not necessarily looking for the younger trees if I happen to find them. I'm usually trying to target the bigger trees, and the best time of year to look for them is in leaf off. So if you can get out in the fall or in the spring or even in the winter and look for trees, that's the easiest time. They have such stout twigs, they stand out. So the branching tends to be like somewhat upward arcing, I would say, towards the tips, and they're very stout and kind of lumpy looking. So that's usually a good indication you have something that's in the butternut group. And then usually like a very light tan bark. That's kind of where I start. And then I'll actually look at buds and then look at the coloration in the twigs as well. And then try to determine the land use history and think about whether it could be a hybrid or not. The hybrids can have more of a pinkish hue on their mature bark, kind of in between the furrows. And then more elongate lenticels on the new twig growth. So, but there's no telltale, there's no like exact science, I would say. There's like a combination of factors you need to look at to determine if it's a hybrid. And whether, you know, usually if you find a larger tree and it has very little canker, it's a good chance it's a hybrid. But that's the other way to find it, is look for the tree with the tinker, the weeping sun. Which is, I shouldn't laugh, but you know, it's a very easy way to find them. Almost all of the native trees have canker on some level. So, yeah, it's kind of a sad tale. But when we are out in the field, or when I'm out in the field, it's typically just sort of walking the habitat and sort of scanning the canopy line, looking for those shapes. You got to cue in on the shape of the branches, and that's really the best start.
Is that canker non-native to here?
Yes. Yes, that was fungal introduction. I haven't read the specifics on it, but there's quite a few papers available looking at
probably
the history.
Probably came in on lumber or on that Japanese species horticulturally or something.
It's probably a horticulture introduction, most likely. Came in on other plant material.
What are the other, you know, you said that there was a list of non-orthodox species. What were the other ones that were on that list?
Yeah, well, it's non-orthodox means seeds that can't be long-term stored, and that's typically because of the cold can interfere with their ability to break dormancy, or the cold can damage the embryo, or the seed is highly has a lot of lipids in it, and they go rancid. So butternut has high levels of fat, so you can't store the seeds because they go bad. Similar would be oak species. Oak can't be stored in any kind of long-term banking. So yeah, there's quite a few tree species. A lot of tropical tree species would fall into that. And then there's other species that are not trees that are also not orthodox. So just depends on usually the fat content in the seed is like one of the primary factors that we look at as to whether we can long-term store it.
So that's like, so is there a way to long-term store it? Can you freeze it, or it's something that has to be sort of harvested and planted in, you know, a certain amount of time, and that's it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Right now, the best practices for butternut is to germinate the trees and keep them in living collections. But unfortunately, the trees will get canker. They will get infected with the fungus and have canker. So you have to sort of keep collecting seed and keep the collection alive, which is increasingly difficult because the trees, as they get sick, produce less fruit, if any. And then the other storage technique would be using cryogenics, but we are currently not set up to do that. You would have to partner with, I think Cincinnati Zoo is one of the probably premier places for plant storage using cryogenics.
Is butternut a sexy enough species for, you know, like organizations to come together and like work on hybrid crosses to find resistant plants? And do we have, you know, if you found a butternut in the woods that didn't have canker, could it be that is a resistant, you know, particular plant to that?
So is it sexy enough?
You know, like the chestnut. People like the chestnut for some, and it's like the historical reason for that. But butternut's like a, you know, not that, you know, it hasn't had the same sort of impact on humans, I guess.
I think in a way it's had more, but I think because it was a really important food source and a dye source, but because our culture has changed, we don't use it. But you'll often see trees in places that were long-standing like cultural centers for early colonizers as well as indigenous groups. So the trees were highly prized. The nuts are they're delicious, a delicious nut. But it's not. the American chestnut, I think because of its stature, sort of takes the cake on like sexy dying trees.
I had a professor one time for a biology class, and she was describing, we were talking about like some other, you know, animal other than an eagle, and she described the eagle as like the sexy thing that, you know, everyone could draw attention to and to get funding for. So it's just interesting to me how that plays out, especially with plants, because plants don't have, like, they're not cuddly, or, you know, they sort of stay in one place, and they have to do a lot of work sometimes to garner the attention of everyone to, like, care about them.
Yeah, I think butternut has that. I think it still has a lot of that draw. There's quite a few researchers that had worked on it. And I forgot to mention the other way to conserve it is through grafting. There's a lot of papers that came out of the Upper Midwest and from the Forest Service based in the Upper Midwest looking at butternut because it is an important crop species and wildlife species. And there was a lot of interest, but I think the reality of what the canker is doing is making it harder to conserve the trees in the wild. So a lot of the research that was done, a lot of the momentum was more sort of tree production focused and done in sort of research facilities, as opposed to, like, how do we actually do conservation for them in the wild, on site? You know, is there anything that can be done? And the other issue is I'm not sure if it's a different strain, but when the fungus became more widespread, they looked at some of the data, and they found that it was much more virulent in the upper Midwest. There's more mortality in the trees. So I think it's a combination of things. Is, you know, it's sort of the invasive species effect. People get really excited about something, and then as we don't have successes or the problem becomes more widespread, we sort of lose momentum. But with, at least for butternut, with it being red listed, that's puts more sort of weight or more pressure on us as a group to do something. We've had a really hard time, or at least I've had a hard time, collecting fruit for the tree. I'm beat by the squirrels every year, so I just can't get the timing right, and it's something I've never dealt with. Almost all my seed collection work is more traditional herbaceous plants, and I've never had to, like, time perfectly my collection to, like, beat the squirrels. And they're so in tune with when the nuts are ripe. Like, I will never be as good as them.
Yeah, I wonder if there's, like, a way you could, you know, outsmart them and, like, set up a net, you know, or something under the tree to catch them before they hit the ground. No,
yeah.
There's got to be a way to do it.
Yeah, I think I just need trees that have more, produce more, like, and get it timed with more of like a mast year for them. And maybe I can by default grab a couple. But yeah, my collections have been really, really small. So we're hoping to put a collection at the Arboretum, but for, you know, public gardens, they're not trees that are going to look good. You know, they sort of fall in line with like our ash collections here that need extensive treatment or just going to look impaired. I would guess that's the word for them, for just trees that aren't going to look great or live very long. So we're still trying to figure out kind of how to integrate them into a collection in the public gardens, but luckily we have research facilities where we can maintain trees on site as well. But yeah, now that the funding for that project is over, I don't know what the long term is for us with that project. It was a lot of field work, with not, in terms of at least fruit collection, seed collection, nut collection, it was not as successful as I thought it would be. We have a lot more sites that we could return to, but the timing was really difficult. So sort of that like cost benefit we would need some groups to get excited about the conservation of that tree to make it worthwhile for us to spend more time on it, which is sort of the bad reality of it.
Yeah, it seems like a hard thing if, you know, are planting all those seeds and then sort of knowing that they're all going to get canker. And is the grafting done to a Japanese rootstock?
Yeah, as far as I understand, I think you can graft to any of the other walnut species. So I think you can graft to the Japanese or the Burgess walnut. And I know there are some folks doing it. It's just, it's not something I have tried yet or specialized in. You know, being at the Arboretum, we are lucky that we have some researchers, but there's so few of us. We have some woody plant researchers that would definitely like help me learn how to do it, but getting them to have time to participate or to take on that would be kind of tough. So if you know anyone who wants to graft walnut.
I mean, I feel like the more and more I talk to people, there's just so many things people could be doing with plants. It's endless.
Yeah.
There's so much space.
From my memory of being there, there's just a lot of dismissal of any wild trees. It was the whole, like, it could be a hybrid, so we don't know, let's not do anything about it perspective. Mm. Where here, I feel like that's not as prevalent, you know, both because we don't have as many hybrids and also because some of the researchers here that were based in this region published some nice papers about how to identify the hybrids, and they did quite a bit of genetics work to sort of back up their research. I feel like it's more open here to working with the wild trees as opposed to just we're not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Should we transition to the disjunct population?
Sure. So the disjunct idea, I think for me it stems from my history in New England and then moving here and seeing plants I was familiar with here or seeing habitat and thinking to myself, well, this plant should be here and it's not. So sort of trying to piece together that the who and the why in terms of plants, like why is this plant here or why is it not here? And that sort of grew into this question of how many of these plants are disjunct from the East Coast? And is that a sufficient, you know, is that a real category? Is that a thing? And it actually goes back to a paper that Tony Rezinchek wrote on the subject. And that sort of inspired me. But when I reached out to him about it, he said, because initially it was going to look specifically at species of sand plain habitats. And the species specifically were going to be those of more coastal New England and whether they showed up in the upper Midwest. His paper looked more at the Midwest, but not as far. He didn't look at Minnesota. His sample area basically ended in Wisconsin. So there was a few species he had highlighted in there. And I thought, well, maybe I can sort of review, you know, use his methodology, use some of his thinking, and adapt that for this project. But when I reached out to him, he said, well, maybe it's more important just to look at disjunction in general. So that's sort of how the project formed, I would say. But the more I dove into it, the more complicated it felt.
Why is that?
Well, I realize there's no real definitions of disjunction. There's no, you know, and it's, I think we understand it in our minds, like this population is separate from that, you know, this other population, but the distance that makes it qualify as being disjunct is different for each species and would be different based on that species biology, and it would be different in modern times based on what is the habitat in between. So you could have populations that are fairly close, but if there's enough disruption in the landscape, they could actually be really disjunct, like on a genetics level of genetics, I would think. These are just my theories. These were the sort of the aha moments or like question mark moments for me. It's like, what is the set standard for disjunction? How far should I measure? And what kind of came about for me was it was more about looking at both edge of range and disjunction at the same time. So species that were from the core of New England, and then there was a gap in their range and then ended up in Minnesota or the Dakotas or Iowa. I think I also included some of Wisconsin as well when I looked at species, but I ended up going through the flora for our region and sort of looking species by species.
To find ones that you thought would be, that were also in New England?
Yeah, I was looking for ones. I was scoring species. I was specifically looking for species that were in New England or in New York and that had a break in their range and then occurred again in the upper Midwest. One of the issues, though, is, you know, we have really good point data for the U.S., down to the county level for many species, but we don't have that level of detail for Canada, or at least that I'm aware of. So something I was noticing with some of the range patterns, as you look into, you know, some of these species actually just kind of go up and over the U.S. So
yeah,
it became difficult on how to score some of these plants. So if I had to do it all again, I would come up with a better scoring system, I think.
So what did you plug in, you know, how were you sort of finding the location in Minnesota where these populations might be occurring?
Most of this was done just computer-based. It didn't pan out to much field work just because of the amount of time it took to score the flora. One of the sort of emblematic, there's a few emblematic species. I think if you have access to that report, there's a table of, I can't remember, maybe 60 or 70 species on there mm-hmm. that sort of highlighted that I thought were of interest. There's a few coastal plain species, species of xeris that occur out here that also occur in New England. Without the list in front of me, it's hard to say, but I think the most interesting thing for me is that a huge amount of the flora here is actually at edge of range, which when you think about, you know, temperate forests and temperate conditions and transition to plains, like that makes sense. But to see sort of that reality of the, at least in terms of conservation work, how many of the plants in the flora are actually at the very far edge of their range, it makes conservation work for them here really important, at least in my my thinking. We know that those genetics usually at the edges of ranges are more distinct or have more variety than the core.
Interesting.
Sounds like you're in the park.
Yeah, you know what? It's extremely windy here today, and what that means is that the power potentially is going to go out at my house, and I don't have service there, so I had to drive to the illustrious 7-Eleven and get service so I could have the phone call. So
oh my
you're
God.
Hearing the hustle and bustle of Dover, Vermont.
Wow.
Yep. So the gaps from, like, you know, I'm imagining, is there, you know, from New England to Minnesota, what would have, is it glaciers that caused that disjunction? Or what is the, you know, what was the mechanism for that?
Yeah, glacial patterns. We had two glacial periods here in Minnesota. to advances and recessions. And then just also the Great Lakes are a barrier as well. And then now in modern times, like major agriculture that occurs in the areas around the Great Lakes, like up into Canada. There's tons of questions around that. But yeah, it's primarily glacial patterns. And some of these species are just naturally circumboreal species that they're just kind of dipping down into like northern New England, and they just kind of dip down into the upper Midwest, and they just skip areas. They just maybe lack a suitable habitat.
And is that a transition? I feel like you're hinting at a transition into rhodiola with a circumboreal species.
Well, you have interest in rhodiola, so maybe you start.
My interest comes from, you know, the family that it comes from. Was it the Crassulaceae? But that, you know, it's always interesting to me, the ones that are like the plants that are completely different from what you would think you would see out in the woods. And I was amazed that rhodiola grew around here. I think Shorn's actually seen it somewhere in Vermont. I think he has a couple pictures of it. But it's, you know, those like succulent leaves, and we have sort of a, you know, a sedum here that's sort of an escapee from, I forget what the species name is on it, but it sort of escaped from gardens, and I see that on occasion, and it's you know, very pretty. I think it has purple flowers, but this one with the like reddish orange, it's really interesting that it's on these sort of higher elevation rock outcroppings, and so that's Rosia is the one that's in Vermont. And then I think you were talking about a different species, right? Integrifolia?
Yeah. So I've seen Rosia in like coastal Maine. It's been really, it was on one of the islands sort of in the Acadia, Scudic Point area. That was really cool. It's a really impressive little plant. But yeah, we have Rhodiola integrifolia subspecies leedii, and that grows here in Minnesota. And then the next population, there's two other sort of population cores. One is in New York State, and then the other is in the Black Hills of South Dakota, and that's it for that species. So it's super interesting, but that's like the most emblematic disjunct that I can think of that we have.
And so you were thinking about doing some research on it?
Yeah, so that species is federally listed, so it's really well studied. There's only, I think, four populations here in Minnesota, the one in South Dakota, and I think there's two in New York. There's a researcher out of Illinois who's done genetics work and population demographics, and now the Arboretum is more involved in terms of seed banking, and we're trying to get a good understanding of propagation. One of our program's goals is to always have the propagation tools to work with these plants. We try to not bank things that we can't take out of the bank without the skills to take them out. So if we had to grow these plants and put them back in the wild for augmentation, translocation, whatever it may be, we want to have the sort of science and the research background in our labs, in our greenhouses, to know how to do that and to know if we can do it, because that helps inform sort of the bigger conservation picture for these plants. Some plants we can grow, some we can't. So that's sort of like why we're really invested in the orchid work as well, is if we can't, we can bank the seed, but if we can't take it out of the bank, it's not very useful.
Yeah.
the rhodiola is one of those that we're working on. We have seeds. We are able to grow it, but we don't know because it's – so that species is a cliff-dwelling species, so we have to figure out how to basically reattach it or attach seedlings to the rock faces and get them to survive. So we haven't gotten to that point yet, but we're sort of experimenting with attaching plants to rock faces, doing some work with a species of ball cactus. So when we figure that out, maybe we can then move on to the sheer, those grow on like rocky bulbs, whereas the rhodiola grows on like sheer cliffs. So we're going to, like, step one, adhere plants to rocky bulbs. Step two, adhere plants to rocky cliffs.
So, yeah, it sounds like the populations of that plant grow in some pretty remote areas that are probably hard to get to. And I thought I read that they like, you know, sort of like the wind tunnel section of the cliff. So between two pieces of rock where the wind is at a higher speed and it's probably, you know, dipping that temperature a few more degrees.
Yeah, I guess I didn't realize that, but yeah, the sites are usually like on a narrower, usually on a part of the cliff that's very steep and the river is somewhat narrowed. So yeah, that would make a lot of sense. But the sites are all pretty difficult to access. Some are on private land, some on public. Most of them are on private though, but we basically lug ladders down steep banks and then down into the river channel and then walk through the river channel to the cliff faces and then sort of periodically set up these long extension ladders and have somebody foot the ladder at the base of like the talus rubble while someone else goes up and collects the seed heads if there's any seed in them. So it's pretty fun. It's a little dangerous.
Is that a species that has low germination? I mean, low, like, seed production?
I don't know, but this past year when we did collection, it did. We had a really bad drought year. We had a really extreme drought for a big chunk of the season. And when we sampled the rhodiola in Minnesota, the seed set seemed really, really low. So it'll be interesting. We're going to go back and collect again, whether it's going to be this year or maybe the year after, but we'll at least be able to compare. I think a lot of plants, including the rhodiola, just aborted flowers because of the drought. So just wasn't able to set seed.
And they flower what time of year?
We were there for seed collection in July. So I'm guessing late May. They're male and female plants, so we have to kind of, and they look very similar. So even when it was funny, we were collecting seed and some of the male plants were actually flowering. Like, they didn't get the memo.
Oh, that's great. It seems like it would be really difficult for them to, like, get pollination, you know, based on the location they're in with wind or... They're not really making it easy.
No, they're a plant. I don't know.
Wind pollinated.
No, I don't think they are. But maybe they have some mixed adaptation to that. But yeah, that's a good question. I actually don't know.
Well, do you know the secret to germinating the seeds?
They germinate readily in the lab. So we do just basic cold stratification in the lab and then germination on standard material. And I think that we've had good success with that. The challenge we've seen is keeping them long-term. So we're able to get them to germinate and live for a few years and then the plants die. So that's been the challenge for us. That can be kind of standard when you're growing, you know, plants in a greenhouse is how to keep them over the long term is the challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure putting them back into their, you know, natural habitat would help at least a little bit with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we don't know, so we'll run some experiments probably this year or the following. We're going to try to get out to the Black Hills and collect seed for that site, so we'll have another like reference point for our understanding. That site was only found fairly recently. It wasn't known to exist there, so we're excited to be able to get out and take a look at that site. But yeah, it'll be interesting. The restrictions, because it is federally listed, are make it a little harder to navigate, but with all permits in place, we're able to still continue to work on the species and come up with a conservation plan that is useful. Some of the sites, the genetics are more bottlenecked from the populations just being separate from each other. So we have to sort of start to talk about what, if augmentation would be suitable and sort of how we would go about that. So those are like kind of the next hurdles for that species, from my understanding.
Is that just like an ethics question you have to get over?
Ethics? No. Well,
you know, I mean, because you're saying that there's a population that has limited genetic material, genetic sharing, and bringing in another plant from outside of that genetic material to who knows what,
yeah,
maybe strengthen them?
Yeah, that would be the goal, is to introduce genetics to bolster and improve the sort of vigor of that population. The decision is when to do it, like how long, like how long do you watch the population decline, and at what threshold do you step in? And that's different for every species. And, you know, I hate to use this example, but, you know, if the plan is not in place with a clear threshold, with federal species, you can't step in. So, like, I don't know if you saw in the news about the manatees that lost their feeding grounds, and they're a federally listed species and under protections with federal government, but they didn't have any alternative like forage plan for that species, so they couldn't do anything. So similar with this plant, like if we don't define what that threshold is, we might sort of walk past it without kind of knowing. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah. Is it an ethics question? Like, do we, you know, in my mind, it makes sense to do that, you know, at least have some sort of decision made about when you do something, you know, sooner rather than later. But, you know, what are your other options, really?
Yeah, I mean, it is ethics, too. It's getting people on board, different groups on board, getting, you know, scientists with Fish and Wildlife on board, getting the primary researchers for the species on board. So it is just sort of going through the steps, but, you know, I don't know what that threshold is if it's not already established, and I think you have to rely on the species expert, which, you know, we are there to support many species, but we aren't the expert for this one, mm-hmm. so we would default to the expert. But, yeah, it's complicated, I think, and there is ethics, and then there's that sort of gut reaction, I think, in general. There's hesitancy around working with plants, at least what I've seen in my career. You know, less hesitancy that we see with animals to sort of augment, move, adjust. You know, it seems more clear, more tangible for some reason with animals.
They're
sexier. Plants. They are.
Not to me. Not to me.
Yeah, there's that thing. I mean, there is that, you know, connectivity level. You can't make eye contact with a plant, so I don't know. I think mussels have it hard. Insects have it hard. But, you know, they still, I don't know, there's still that, like, the unknowns with plants, and there's always, like, you get into a tough meeting and someone will say, well, we don't know the genetics, and everybody will throw their hands up and no one will do anything. So,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of hard questions that have to get answered. But I think the nice thing about at least the groups we work with and within our own group at the Arboretum, is we're willing to try. And it's nice that we have the facilities to try things, and we're willing to try projects in the field, in the wild, and try them as research and see what happens. So, I don't know. I think that's the approach that we tend to take, is do the best we can with what we have, the best knowledge we have right now. So.
Yeah, that the rhodiola is also going to have a hard time probably with climate change, and you know, these, you know, I think does it occur in North Carolina? I feel like it's somewhere down in North Carolina on top of like Mount Mitchell or something. Just on those, you know, really high elevation areas that will over time, oh, I'm about to see an accident. over time, you know, those areas are going to get warmer and warmer. And sort of that habitat is going to be, you know, lost. It's not like there's going to be more of it. They can't go up any further. Like mixing that genetic material with something that, you know, I don't know, see what happens. But otherwise, it's just gone. And that's another species that's, you know, another species the humans have killed.
Take it to the depressing place. Yeah. No, I think our hope is to see some decisions made about that threshold, at least for this species and this subspecies of Rhodiola integrifolia, see what threshold we should set for the most challenged populations, and then sort of work from there. You know, we're not going to be crossing this or creating a hybrid. It's just, can we bolster the genetics from these disjunct populations you know, in the case of Minnesota, we have several local populations. They're kind of in a two-county area. Can we kind of bolster through what we have there? So that's going to be our approach. But yeah, so Minnesota in particular, climate is a big factor. The further north you go, the more the warming effect has. So we are warming faster than some other places. So it's a real concern for Minnesota.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like almost 60 here today, which is weird.
That sounds lovely.
Yeah, it's, I'm not complaining. I actually don't like snow, but the warm weather is, it's nice to have one every you know, month or so, if you know, if we can. But it's gonna snow a foot on Friday, so we're gonna quickly be back into winter.
I'm guessing you're getting the same weather we were getting. We had a 40 degrees on Sunday, and then that night we had a storm come in, and then between Monday and Tuesday we got about a foot of snow. So and it was minus 5 last night, so big swing.
It started to warm up recently, but it's going to dive back down. I feel like, I always say this, I always feel like we're going to get out of winter, but then we end up sitting in until like the middle of April or the end of April.
So that optimism.
I know. I don't know where it comes from, because I'm from New England. We're not optimistic people.
No. It is true, though. I mean, we've been getting weird weather patterns. We had tornadoes and, like, thunder and lightning in December this year. So that was kind of interesting. But, yeah, different weather patterns makes it tough for the plants, for sure. Conservation work is humbling, I think. Plants in general, humbling, and then sort of working with rare plants. It's super humbling. I always think I have a handle on, you know, either a habitat or a suite of species, and then I have no clue. when I moved here, you know, like the simple plants, like pink lady slipper, you know, you have a very, like, you know, the habitat that it's going to be in, and have an understanding of that plant. And then I moved here, and it's like, it's a wetland species here. I'm like, my world, it's upside down.
That happens to me when I go almost anywhere, and I see, it's almost like I can't recognize them out of context of, you know, my own habitat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yep. Looking at plants, but that's when you get to see the different things, and that opens up a whole new door of like, oh wow, this is, you know, there's a question there somewhere that can be looked into or researched, or that's the fun stuff, exposing yourself to all different kinds of habitats and plants, and how are these all connected, and when you can recognize stuff, you know, that's like a whole different level when you can apply it to where you're from and like how it relates in your own place.
Yeah, I think that's most exciting. Like, I love traveling, and like the upper Midwest is huge. And I also make, you know, trips down to the Southwest, and getting to see the same species in different habitats or plants of the same family. That's when my brain just, there's all these little sparks that go off. I'm like, oh! and more questions. But yeah, I think that's the exciting stuff for sure.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk to me.
Thanks for having me, Tom. It was great.
Yeah, and we should stay connected.
Of course. Come out anytime. You can come out.
Okay.
We can collect seeds. You can come check out the orchids in the lab. It'd be pretty great.
I would love to do that. I might take you up on that. I'm like, since COVID and all this stuff, I'm like hooked on just going places.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to do more traveling and less real work.
Twin Cities are actually really easy to fly into, and we have one of the best like food scenes I've ever encountered. When I moved here, I was like, it's so accessible, and oh my gosh, the food is amazing. So
it's got to be better than Wardsboro, Vermont. I can tell you that. There's like literally nothing here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. I don't live here for that reason. Thank you so much. And I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Okay, we'll see ya.
All right.